Thank you. It's delightful to be here. I see we have 55 participants, which is really exciting. A very brief background on me. I started writing books about the old Sears kit homes in 2002. I actually wrote my first articles in the late 90s and became something of an expert, I guess, and had a fun run, wrote 9 books on topics around architecture. And then in 2006, I met the man I thought was the love of my life. I had prayed without ceasing that I would find love. I had been married the first time for many years, and that ended in divorce. So I was very grateful to find this man. In fact, my wedding vows, when we were married January 1st, 2007. My wedding vows were pretty much a public thank you to God for bringing this wonderful man into my life. And then after about 10 years of marriage, he came home for lunch one day. He was an attorney, a litigator. Came home for lunch one day, sat down in a comfortable chair and put a gun in his mouth and ended his life. And to say it destroyed me is an understatement. I share this story with many people because until you've experienced, it's said that suicide is a death like no other, and that's accurate. We're called suicide survivors. We're the people who have survived the suicide of a close loved one. And I lost my mind. I guess it would be likened to a psychotic break. And a couple mental health workers told my family that because of the extreme the circumstances surrounding this were so dark. My husband had left behind a short note blaming me for his decision to end his life, which was kind of a red herring. I had been a good wife. Took me a while to sort all that out, but it was a mess. And my family really didn't know what to do. And a couple of mental health care workers involved suggested that long-term care should be found for me because I would probably not be able to care for myself for a long, long time. And we all considered putting me in a psychiatric ward for the immediate need. And my friend, Milton, who Craig mentioned a moment ago, intervened and said, no, she'll finish herself off in a psych ward. That's not what Rosemary needs. And he stepped in and offered to take care of me until I was right in the head again. And during this time, I went kind of from pillar to post, and I tried staying with different people, and it went very badly. I was plagued by the most horrific nightmares. In the nightmares, I ran to my husband just as he put the gun in his mouth, and I lived through that suicide every night for months. And there came a time when I realized I couldn't get comfortable in anybody's home, and so for a time, I actually was sleeping in my car, living out of my car. Which, you know, to go from my husband and I had kind of been an interesting couple. We had lived in the southeastern Virginia area, not too far from Virginia Beach, and I'd had some success as an author, and he was a prominent litigator, and I fell pretty far pretty fast. But I couldn't get comfortable in my home again after what he had done. I couldn't get comfortable in anybody's home, and the nightmares. And I'm a writer. I'm a very sensitive soul. It was very hard for me to deal with. And 2.5 years passed this way, and I tried so desperately to pull myself up by my bootstraps. You know, America, the rugged individualist of America. I tried everything I knew to do. I literally filled my house with affirmation, Bible verses, my favorite sayings of Jesus. I covered the walls of my I was in a rental home at this point, living with Milton. Milton had moved into the rental house, one, to help with expenses, and also because I was still losing a great deal of weight at this time. I became physically unable to eat, and I was living off liquid protein drinks. And he tried desperately to get me to eat. He would make dinner every night, and he would literally follow me around the house with some decent meal, some lovely meal, and literally ask me to just take one bite. So I lost a great deal of weight very quickly. And I mean, I was pretty much a mess at this point. So after 2.5 years, I really, pardon me, I wasn't doing well, and I struggled with suicidal ideation endlessly, every day. And every day I would give myself a reason to make it for 24 more hours. I would say, don't kill yourself today. You haven't finished that will. Don't kill yourself today. You still need to change the beneficiaries on the bank account. And every day I was literally living day by day, trying desperately not to do to my children what he had done to me. And truthfully, I was running out of road. I was suffering profoundly from PTSD. So much so that when I tried to go out to eat somewhere, if there was a loud noise or a bang, I'd become very agitated, jump up, and typically run out of the restaurant. There were only certain people I felt comfortable with. And so I was very careful about with whom I went out, because not everyone understood that if I saw something in a Walmart or I saw something in a store, I would become very emotional and have to leave immediately. So at 29 months after all this, I had mastered the art of pretending. I knew I was a Hollywood level actress. I knew how to pretend to be happy, because oh my goodness, the things people say to a trauma survivor, so inappropriate. And, you know, if I were queen of the world, one of the things I would love to see is teaching clergy and even doctors how to deal with people who've been through extreme trauma. You know, an example, I guess, I don't know if it was one day or 3 days after this happened, I had lost the ability to swallow. It was like my throat just seized up. And you can go a while without food. You can't go very long without drinking anything. So my daughter, and I think Milton went with her, took me to one of these urgent care facilities. And we were checked in, and I went in the back room with my daughter. And I was sitting on the edge of the gurney there. And the doctor came in very affable, very, very pleasant. He said, "So, ladies, what's the problem?" And my daughter said, "Well, her husband killed himself 3 days ago, and she can't swallow, she can't drink, she can't eat anything." And the doctor, now this is a doctor, hopefully with some background in emergent care, and he was about my age, so he wasn't some young kid. He literally reeled back and he said, "Oh my gosh, my Aunt Bertha's husband did the same thing, and she was never right in the head again." And my daughter, to her credit, she was, gosh, I think she was in her early 30s at this point. She turned to him and she said, "Doctor, that is not helpful. Are you going to be able to help my mother or not?" And he kind of composed himself and he wrote a prescription for, I think, a 90 count of benzodiazepines, which are a tranquilizer. And that was helpful. I was not one to take drugs, but boy, those benzos hit the spot. And I was able to eat after I took a couple of the Valium, actually, is what I was taking. But that was really a stopgap measure. So, as I said, in time, I abused alcohol. I became addicted to prescription drugs. As I said, I lived out of my car briefly. At one point, I developed a skin condition, and it was because I wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't practicing even basic hygiene. So I really wish there was a way to teach people how to deal with trauma. So at 29 months, I had learned how to pretend to be happy. I had learned how to keep a smile on my face in public. And then at home, I would think about the best way to end my life. And I put a lot of energy into thinking about how to do this. It was pretty dark. So at 29 months, I developed some frightening symptoms. I had a fever that came and went. I had night sweats. And I had some unusual, let's just say, female trouble. And I went to a gynecologist where I was diagnosed with cancer, small cell squamous cancer, cervical cancer. So I was referred immediately to an oncologist, a gynecological oncologist, and he set me up for chemo and daily radiation. And he did a cursory exam, and he determined that it was at least stage two, because he said the cancer had already advanced to a point where the flesh was distorted. He could see it on physical exam. And I was supposed to start chemo pretty quick, and he had scheduled a biopsy to find out exactly how far this had gone. And I went into surgery September 5th, Wednesday morning, and it was expected that this was going to be no big deal. It turned out to be a really big deal. And they did the surgery, and they took samples, and they it took me 3 hours to wake up from this 20-minute procedure. I have never been one to take drugs. I've always relied on spiritual healing. I've always believed that, you know, we can trust God with pretty much everything. So this thing of taking these drugs really, really hit me hard. So when I woke up from this, the RN that was attending me, and this was a large hospital in, again, the southeastern Virginia area, I told the RN that I was bleeding profusely. And she said, "Oh, once you get home, lie down, you'll be fine." Two more times I told her I was bleeding profusely. As a 59-year-old woman at this point, I know how things are supposed to work, and I knew I was losing a phenomenal amount of blood. She sent me home anyway, despite my three times of saying something's gone wrong. So it was about a 40-minute drive back to my home. And by the time I got home, I had ruined my friend's car seat. I mean, I was on towels and pads and everything else. It was awful. So at home, I had a lovely home with white carpet, and I was very concerned about messing up that white carpet because when you're bleeding to death, housekeeping is a priority. So I was pretty worried about that. So I went into my walk-in shower and I stood in my walk-in shower while I sorted out what to do because I knew I was bleeding to death. And as I stood in the shower, I might even have the shower on, frankly, I saw the blood just going down the center drain in that white tiled shower, and I knew it wouldn't be long. And I remember thinking, you've been trying to figure out how to exit this place for 29 months, and now you're looking at chemo, radiation. Doctor said there's a 70% chance one course of chemo will take it. If not, you got to do it again. There's a 10% chance you'll die from this. I mean, his statistics were pretty clear. And I thought, this is your out. Maybe this is God's grace. Maybe this is God's mercy to exit off this thing, to be done, an answer to your prayers, literally. Because at this time, I had actually been praying for my husband when he pulled the trigger. And of all the hits that I took from this, my faith took the hardest hit. I had prayed for him literally, faithfully, three times a day. I could not imagine life without this man. I felt like I'd spent my whole life looking for him and had found him. And I asked when he went off to work, I would ask the angels very specifically, watch over him today, keep him safe from harm, illumine his path, put the love of God in his heart, put the love of Christ in his eyes, help him see others as Jesus sees others. I mean, I had some very specific prayers I prayed every single day. So to know that he died under all those prayers, it just was devastating. So in the shower, I'm thinking about all this. I'm thinking about the fact that my prayers have done nothing. I had been praying for myself for 29 months to be healed of this misery and this trauma and this sadness, to stop being a burden to other people. I mean, I had been a successful, independent woman. I did not want to need a caregiver. I did not want to need somebody taking care of me, helping me remember how to eat. I mean, I had been a writer. I had read thousands of books. And in the thick of this, at one point, I remember I had given up on reading. I had lost the, I tell you, when somebody's had a severe trauma, it's a lot like a stroke in terms of what it does to your mental acuity. I had always considered myself something of a smart cookie. And I know one day about a year and a half into this, I was standing at the stove and I decided in rare form, I decided to bake a cake from a box mix. And I think the ingredients were a couple eggs, some oil, some water, and it might have been something else, I don't know. But I remember looking at those directions and reading the words and not understanding what it was telling me. And I became so agitated and so frustrated that I handed the box and the other things over to my friend, again, Milton. And I said, I don't know what it's saying. I can't put it together. I can't figure it out. And he said, it's okay. He said, I'll do it. It's okay. So to go from being a writer who's written nine books, who's read thousands of books, to not being able to read the recipe on a box cake mix, it gives you an idea of the extent of damage. It was like a nuclear bomb had gone off in my brain. I could read, but it was like somebody took a bucket full of words and threw them against the wall. I saw the words, but I didn't know what they meant altogether. So in this shower, I realized, I've been mentally compromised, physically compromised, emotionally, I'm a mess. Mentally, I'd been diagnosed with, I think it's called CPTSD. I thought, this is God's mercy. And so as I leaned against that wall in the shower, again, still bleeding profusely, I thought, all you got to do is sit down in the shower. And in a few minutes, somebody will come in to check on you, and it will be too late, and you'll be gone. And that will be that. And then maybe this is how God has answered my prayers for 29 months. And I thought about this. I thought about it quite a bit. And I thought about all the energy Milton and others had invested in saving me. And Milton's sister, Mabel, had come from Ohio. I was living again in the Virginia Beach area. And so she was in the living room with Milton, in the living room of my home. And they were just waiting for me to come out of the shower. And I guess they were expecting that the bleeding would stop. And I thought about the two of them, that Mabel had driven from Ohio to take care of me, and Milton had been such a faithful friend. And I thought, is that fair to have them come into the shower in 10 or 15, 20 minutes and find me splayed on the floor, bled to death? And I thought, no, that isn't fair. They have done so much. So many people have done so much. I have a blog, searshomes.org, and again, about the architecture. And I would often, after my husband's suicide, I would often just put on that blog, please pray for me today, I'm losing it. And boy, oh boy, the people so faithfully would respond and say, Rosemary, I am holding you up in prayer. Rosemary, I'm holding you in the light of God's love. I can't tell you, on my darkest, most difficult times, I would literally lay in my bed with my little phone in my hand, and I would read the comments where people's, one comment that I just cherished, a woman said, you remind me of a Sears house that my grandmother built. It's small, but it's sturdy, and it has survived the worst storms. And you would look at this modest house, and you wouldn't think that it could survive so much difficulty, so much bad weather, so many years, but it has survived. And you are like that, and you are in my prayers. So I would just hold my phone in as I laid in bed and remember, these people are praying for me. So again, back to that shower, I thought, yeah, I'm dying. And this won't take long. And so I realized if I sit down, I wasn't going to be able to get back up. I was already starting to feel weak. And there's sound effects on it. If you can hear the ambulance out my window. And I pushed off the wall and I walked outside and I told Mabel and Milton, call an ambulance. I'm dying. It won't be long. An ambulance came, took me to a local ER, not far from the house. It was a standalone ER. It was not connected to a hospital, which might not have been a good choice for Rosemary. So again, nobody seemed to understand the urgency of the situation. So I got to the ER, they put me in a cubicle. They examined me fairly quickly. And I do remember it was a very, very young ER doctor that looked at me. And I remember she said, and I don't know if she meant to say this out loud, but she said, there's so much blood, I just can't see anything. Despite that, they packed me with gauze. And at the time, there was this RN about my age standing to my left, and I'm on the gurney. And the RN, I grabbed her hand because, you know, now I've decided to live. Let's get this show on the road. And I grabbed that RN's hand. I said, promise me you're not going to let me die. And she said, oh, honey, we have many solutions for this. We're not going to let you die. So after they packed me with gauze, they left the room. And Milton is my faithful friend. Milton's to my side, sitting in the little chair they have. And they hooked me up to a blood pressure monitor, and I had a pulse ox on my finger. And Milton said, oh, and they gave me a shot of Dilaudid, which is a morphine derivative. And you know, when somebody's bleeding to death, turns out that might not be the best thing to do. So Milton said after that, you know, and they walked out, left me there. And Milton said he was watching that blood pressure monitor, and at one point, it just kept going down and down. At one point, it went to 32 over 25. And he said at that point, he was jumping up to run out and get the retrieve the doctor. And he said, I woke up and I had been unconscious at this point. And he said, your eyes popped open and you tried to sit up on the gurney, which is very impressive for somebody with a blood pressure of 32 over 25. But he said, you couldn't quite sit up. So you reached your arms up and you wiggled your fingers almost like a child reaching up for a beloved parent. And he said, you spoke very briefly. And Milton said, he stood up and he looked over me. And he said, it was like, I wasn't even there. He said, you looked right through me. And then after just a few seconds, he said, you flopped back on the gurney. And that's when the blood pressure went to error, which meant it was now lower than 32 over 25. Meanwhile, I was having a wonderful time. Absolutely wonderful. I was in a deep, unconscious, dreamless state at the moment of my death. And I woke up when I died, and I woke up being catapulted out of my body. And I mean, catapulted. It was very, very dramatic. And I remember, I don't know if it was a feeling, a thought, a vision, what, but it was as though there was a silvery, glistening, sinewy strand of something from the crown of my head to the heel of my toe. And it was like an archer's bow that had been pulled back and popped. And with that pop, that's when I went flying out of my body. And there was a sound. There was a sound like a plop when I left my body. Mary C. Neal, in her book about her own near-death experience, she wrote, it was the sound that a stone makes when it plunks into the water. And I thought, that's, you know, later, I realized that's a pretty good description. So I was floating further and further away from my body, and I was in this perfect blackness, this perfect darkness. And this darkness was comfort, peace and joy as a verb. It was actively comforting me. It was actively giving me peace and joy. And it, you know, I know people say this, but I'm a wordsmith. There are no words really to describe this perfect peace. I remember one of the thoughts I had as a writer, I've always struggled with anxiety and worries and, oh no, what's going to happen next? And I remember thinking in this experience, that didn't come with me. I have no anxiety. I have no worries. I have no fears. I have no angst. And I remember thinking, I've always wondered what I would look like with no fears and no worries and no angst and no panic. And I thought, this is great. And another very early, well, actually my very first thought was my heart has stopped. And I thought, how do I know that? I thought, I don't know how I know that, but I know that's right. And I remember thinking, won't they all be surprised how this ended? And I, you know, like the tombstone for the hypochondriac, I told you I was sick. All along the line, it seemed like nobody believed that I was really not, that I was really bleeding that badly. And a very early thought was, I thought, I'm dying. And then being a longtime writer and editor, I said, actually, you're not dying, you're dead. Because when you're dancing off this mortal coil, the most important thing is correcting your tense. And I thought that was pretty darn funny, that I'm correcting my tense as I'm dying or dead. And I laughed out loud and I heard myself laugh. I heard my very own Rosemary unique giggle. And I do remember thinking, I don't think I have lungs. I know I don't have breath sounds. Pretty sure I don't have vocal cords, but I'm still producing all the sounds that I made in that body back there. And I thought, how cool is that? And it was really such a joy that everything I am, everything I really am, goes with me. And all that got left behind was the darkness, the sadness, the negativity, the worries, and all of that. And I also felt that it was pretty cool that my goofball sense of humor went with me. I'm correcting my tense as I'm dying. And this, you know, if somebody had told me after I came back from this that I had been dead for 2 weeks, I would have believed them. Einstein, one of my favorite Einstein quotes, to those of us who are committed physicists, the past, present, and future are only illusion, however persistent. You know, we see time as linear. We have the past, the present, and the future all on this timeline. But in this experience, it's hard to say exactly how these events unfolded or at what time they unfolded. In some ways, it seemed like it was all happening at once. And very early on, while I'm still floating in this blackness, I felt this massive spiritual presence join me. And I mean massive. And it was as though it was there to say, you know, welcome home. It was a greeting almost. And I turned to my left and looked slightly behind me, pretty intrigued by the fact that I'm turning what I think is my head to my left to see this being that has joined me. I thought, wow, I guess I still have a human-esque form in this. And I asked the being, because, you know, now it's even better. I have this lovely companion with me. And I said with a lilt in my voice, I said, and who are you? And the answer was immediate. And it was, it came with, I'm pretty sure I was speaking out loud, but again, it's hard to know. But the answer was immediate. The answer was, you, Rosemary, you are the image and likeness. I'm the original. And that's Genesis 1, I think it's 27. Which has always been a favorite Bible verse of mine, but I've always struggled to really understand what that meant, to be the image and likeness of God. And I remember thinking, wow, it's the original. And it so helped me to understand that Bible verse. It just meant so much to me to get that, to really understand what that one verse meant. I thought, wow, can this possibly get any better? It was just fantastic. It was wonderful. It was so affirming. And I remember thinking so many times, I wish there's so many things that I'm knowing now that I wish I had known back then, you know, back in this earthly life, which already seemed like way in the past. And I know I had no intention of coming back, even in death, even in this experience of passing on. I remember thinking very clearly. I remember thinking about the fact that I had wanted to die, and I had not done this to myself, that my children and my loved ones would not have to live with the sadness, the horror of a loved one that killed themselves, that this had been a medical mistake. This had been a medical procedure that had gone terribly wrong. And it's kind of amazing to me that even in death, my husband's suicide was still something that I had an awareness of. That was pretty, that's pretty sobering now. So as this experience went on, there were so many thoughts that assailed me from so many directions, all good, all very positive, all very inspiring, all very clear. And one of the puzzles of my life throughout my life, since Raymond Moody came out with the book Life After Life in 1976, I'd spent a lifetime literally reading every NDE book I could get my hands on, from Betty Eady to Eben Alexander, everything I could get my hands on. Danyon Brinkley was a favorite. I read that so many times I almost memorized it. And in this blackness, as I'm floating away further and further away from my body, I had an awareness that I had been within this earthly experience. I had been in this blackness before. I had done this before. And I asked this now just spiritual being with me, not the massive one that had said, I'm the original, but another spiritual being that accompanied me. I said, what is this memory? I have been here before. And the answer was, again, immediate. The answer was, remember, your mom told you when you were an infant, you were given up for dead. And your mom said it was the prayers of her and others that the nuns said, it was a Catholic hospital nuns, that brought you back. I was a newborn infant, and I was literally given up for dead. And the angel told me, they said, you didn't almost die then. You had your NDE as an infant, and that's why you have a memory of this. But you were sent back then, and that's why your whole life you felt so different. That's why you've had a hunger for learning more about the near-death experience. And I remember saying, I think I said, hey, you know what? That would have been real good to know back there. But hey, thanks. Good to know. Good to know. And another one of the thoughts I had is, I'm still floating away in this blackness. And it was like velvet. It was like actively velvety comforting me in every way, in every way. And I remember feeling like I was a billionth of a drop of water in the ocean being reunited with the ocean. And one of the Bible verses I thought about was Paul talked about the peace that passeth all understanding. I think it's Corinthians, but he talks about the peace that passeth all understanding. Thought, this is what Paul was talking about. This peace, this perfect peace. There's no way to explain it, no way to understand it, no way to tell other people about it. You have to experience it to get it. And I was also so pleased that I remembered everything. I could remember Bible verses. I could remember my favorite Bible verses. I remembered that I was supposed to start chemotherapy. I remembered that, that was over. And boy, I tell you, people tend to say so many things, but somebody's, oh, you wanted to come back. You weren't ready to go. Nope. I was very ready to go. In fact, I remember thinking, perhaps saying, that I really felt like I'd been granted early release for good behavior. It had not been an easy life, and I was overwhelmingly grateful that it was over. My whole life, I kept gratitude list. Every morning, I wake up and write out five things I was grateful for. Even in the depths of my despair, I'd always try to find something each morning to be grateful for. And so, in that habit of gratitude, in this experience, I was thinking, I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful it's over. I'm out. I'm free. I'm clear. I get the new slate. I get a start over. I get a do-over. I'm going on. And that was just so, so powerfully wonderful. And the way I know, one of the ways I know I had no intention of coming back, I remember saying, this is great. I like floating. Floating is fun. And as a wordsmith, if I had any intention of coming back, I would have been far more effusive and clear in my language. I would have used bigger, more expressive words than I like floating. Floating is fun. Because when I did return from this, when I was out of the hospital, I wrote down every detail so that I would not forget it. And I wrote out those words on my laptop in bed. And I remember thinking, oh, come on. I like floating. Floating is fun. That's the best you can do after 30 years of writing. So at some point in this experience, again, it's hard to put a timeline on it. At some point, I got a memory wipe or something, because at one moment I'm floating in this blackness, again floating further and further away from my body. And one of the most often questions I get was, did you see your body? I did not. Milton, it's so good to have a witness to your life and your death. Milton told me later that he had been outside the emergency room door, after my blood pressure stopped, the medical personnel came rushing in the room, and he got shooed out into the hallway. But he said four times the door to that little cubicle opened, and the nurses emerged with armfuls of linen soaked in blood, literally soaked in blood. So I'm very grateful that I did not see my body. And in having thought about this and prayed about this, I believe it was like a loving parent that said, no, you don't need to see this. We're going to cover your eyes. We're going to keep you. You don't need this impressed on memory. So at some point in this floating in this blackness, it stopped. And next thing I knew, I was in a white room. And I don't remember this transition at all. I don't know if I was given a talking to. I don't know if I was shown loved ones who've passed. I have no idea. I have no memory. I know that one moment I was floating further and further away, and the next moment I'm standing in a white room. And I remember thinking, I don't know if I have legs or feet, but I suspect if I have an intention to move, I will move. And at the end of this white room, and I guess, 15, 20 feet away, who knows? But there was a door. And I knew what that door meant. Having read all these NDE books throughout my life, I knew that was the border, the boundary, the gate, the place that we said, hey, there's no going back now. We're crossing the Rubicon. So I remember thinking, out of my way. We do not need to have a discussion about this. I want to go through the door. I'm done. It's over. I'm done, done, done. And I thought, that's when I thought, well, I don't know, legs, limbs, feet, what, but I can't believe I didn't look at my feet. I wish I'd looked at my feet. Even look at what I'm wearing. Oh, I've heard that's a common regret of people who have near-death experiences. They forget to look at their body. So I started to move through that room toward that door. I couldn't wait. Just couldn't wait. Like a kid going home after you've been away for 58 years. I knew I was going home. And I thought about that song, going home, I'm just going home. And I thought, that's what I'm doing. I'm going home. And I saw that door. And as I'm moving through this white room, it was the whole room was covered in this mist, like a vapor or a fog. And the room was the most perfect white you could ever conceptualize or imagine. It was luminescent, iridescent, perfect, perfect white. And being an architectural historian, I noted that there were no sconces, no light fixtures. It was like the white light was producing itself. It was, I don't know how to define it. It was just coming from everywhere and nowhere. But this mist or vapor was swirling. It was very, very beautiful and very intense. And I remember looking, trying to focus at one of the individual droplets of this vapor. I mean, imagine being in a heavy pea soup fog and trying to focus on a piece of, on a droplet of vapor. And I felt like I should be able to see an individual droplet. And one of the angels said to me, they said, your spiritual eyes have not acclimated to this new environment, but what you're seeing are particles of light. And that's what's swirling and dancing around you are particles of light. And the other thing that I was told is whether I went on to heaven or went back to earth, that we all have to be purified. We can't go to heaven with this burden of sadness or believing that a disease process has ended our life or a memory of some horrible lifelong disease. We have to have those things cleansed from consciousness, and that's what the white room does. It removes these things from us. So as my friend Sandy said once, she said, leave your muddy boots at the door. But some people have been sick for so long that it becomes part of their identity, when it's not. It's not our spiritual identity. And in my case, I had been so trapped in grief that it had become part of who I was. Like I said, I tried so hard to keep the mask on when I was out in the world. And it was so beautiful being in this white room. And I thought, if this is where I spend eternity, this is okay too, because it was so, I just felt perfect peace. And I just felt so at one. Especially having had an NDE as an infant and having been able to see things that others didn't see throughout my life and learning how to shut up about it. People don't want to hear you say, Aunt Susie just passed. And somebody says, how do you know Aunt Susie passed? And they say, well, she just walked by to say goodbye. Did you not see that? People get pretty tired of hearing that pretty fast. So I felt like I was back among my people who understood me, who got me, who loved me, and who enjoyed me and cherished me. So I'm moving with intention toward this door that I see in front of me. Really, I cannot begin to express the joy I felt at this. And I paused at the door. The door was shut, which bothered me because from everything I had read, it seemed like the door should be open. That song I just quoted, Going Home, talks about moving through an open door. And I was a little puzzled by that. And backing up very briefly, I had three prayers I had said ever since my husband's death, pretty much several times a day, or at least once a day for 29 months between his suicide and my own near-death experience. I had asked every night, I said, God, either heal me or let me go. I cannot live in this state. Heal me or let me die. I can't do this. And my second prayer was, there had been so many hard decisions to face. My husband was a litigator. There were some legal messes to clean up after his death. Every decision had such profound consequences. It was agonal. And then my third prayer, and people laugh at this, but I was very serious. My third prayer was to be spared a life review. For 29 months, I had had this recurring nightmare that I could not stop him from doing this, that I approached him just as he, prepared to end his life. And so I beg God, do not, I've seen this every night for 29 months. Spare me a life review. Please do not ask me to live through this again. So as I'm approaching this door in the white room, I came to that door and I paused for just a second. I actually had put my right hand up to push through this door. Pretty interested by the fact that right-handed in heaven, right-handed on earth. I thought, oh man, how cool is that? Again, realizing the essence of who we are, really everything goes with us. We leave nothing behind. And something I guess I should have mentioned, there were so many memories that came at me from every direction of my life. It's like my brain finally got ramped up to realize, when I say my brain, my spiritual essence or consciousness had no loss of memory, no loss of any event that had ever happened to me. It's pretty darn intense. So at this door, I paused and I asked the angel that was with me, I said, is this the divine will for my life? That was my question. And all I could get out is this the divine? And the answer was immediate. And again, with an infusion of knowledge, the answer was no. But whatever you decide, if you decide to go back or you decide to go on to heaven, you go with all of God's blessings and mercy and grace and love and care. There is not a wrong decision. And I cannot begin to describe what that meant to me because I had suffered from so many decisions and it seemed like I often made poor decisions. And here I was told that there is not a wrong decision. And I told the angel with me, I said, I will take that. I do not ask me to go back. I do not want to go back. I remember chemo starting on Monday, radiation starts. I do not want to go back to that. And the sadness, being ostracized by society. I mean, that's a whole nother lecture, how suicide survivors are treated. We're treated like lepers. You want to talk about suicide prevention. Those of us who survived the suicide of a close loved one, according to statistics, and depending on whom you ask, we are 12 to 48 times more likely to end our own life. 12 to 48 times more likely. And yet society tends to push us away because we are scary. We are your worst nightmare. So we are not well treated. And I had lived in isolation. And other than my friend Milton, lots of people kept their distance. And there were those people that rushed into the fray when everyone else was rushing away. But at this door, the angel said, there are no wrong decisions. And that meant the world to me. And as I was preparing to say, okay, I'll take it, let's do this deal, I had a vision, a very intense and clear vision of that nurse at the emergency room who had held my hand shortly before I lost consciousness and said, "Oh, honey, we're not going to let you die." And I saw her. And in this vision, and I do not believe this was a concurrent vision. I believe this was a potential future, frankly. But in this vision, I saw her sitting in a hospital supply room. She was sitting on a little metal stool with her hands, with her head in her hands, leaning forward, sobbing uncontrollably and saying, "I promised that woman I wasn't going to let her die, and I lost her." And I thought, oh, come on, don't do this to me. Do not show me this. And it was, she was crying. It was very difficult to watch. And then I thought, truly, I thought to myself, you know what? She's a nurse. She signed up for this. I need to go. I do not want to go back to Earth. I need to be on my way. And then I didn't just see that nurse. I felt her pain. It was as if I was her for a moment. And I felt that agonal grief. And I recognized it as the grief that I had known, occasioned by my husband's poor choices. And I realized if I could spare one person that level of agony, grief, and sadness, that I had to go back. And something I guess I should mention, and I don't really know the timing of when this unfolded, but I was told if I did agree to go back, that I would be healed, that I would be restored to wholeness. I had been in the white room, and that I would be completely restored. And I don't even remember weighing that, but I do remember the nurse, and I remember thinking, I can't do this to another human being. And I put my right hand by my side, and it had been up to push through that door. I put it down, and I remember saying, "This is going to ruin that nurse's day if I die." And literally in a millisecond of a millisecond, I was back on that gurney. Lots of stuff happening now. They had called pretty much everybody in that little ER into the room. And the nurse, I don't know if it was the same nurse, but there was a nurse right in my face. As soon as I opened my eyes, the nurse was right there. And she said, "What is your name?" And I said, "Rosemary." And she said, "What year is it?" I said, 2018. And she said, "Where are you?" And I said, "A crummy excuse for an ER." At least I was being honest. I learned later that my heart had stopped and I had been more than 10 minutes without a heartbeat, without blood pressure, without any vital signs. And part of what makes this story so dramatic, I mean, there's a lot of elements here, but part of what makes it so dramatic is when somebody dies from bleeding to death, you cannot do CPR because that just pushes more blood out of the body. And I've interviewed a ER physician. I've written a book about this called Remembering the Light. And the ER physician said, "Yeah, you got to plug the leak, refill the tank, and then you restart the heart." So the medical belief is after 10 minutes with absolutely no oxygenation of the brain is mush. The brain is irrevocably damaged. And yet I came back and there was no damage. And I know I shared this story actually with a longtime anesthetist. And when I told him the story, he became emotional. And I said, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "Because you have no idea how happy that all the medical staff was when you had not suffered a cognitive decline, when you were talking and you were engaging and even complaining." So that was part of the miracle, I guess, although I'm hesitant to use the term miracle. So meanwhile, backing up to Milton very briefly, Milton had taken care of me for 29 months, very, very tender, loving care. He could not have taken any better care of me if he was my own dear mother. My mother passed many, many years ago. So he was very good to me. So he told me later, well, Milton had been an avowed atheist. He was very proud of being an atheist. When we were sharing a home there in Portsmouth, Virginia, he would get a magazine called American Atheist. It was a monthly magazine, and he would show it to me. And he would say, "Look, my magazine came." He said, "Would you like to read some of it? It's very intelligently written. I think you'd like it." And I would say, "No, you keep that to yourself." And yet part of his duties that I inflicted on him is he would read me sometimes for an hour, 2 hours at night. He would read to me from the Bible. I found great comfort at night in that 29-month span when I was suffering so. He would read me the 91st Psalm, the 23rd Psalm, the Beatitudes. He would read me Paul's letters. He read me that Bible every night for 29 months. So while he was a very proud atheist, I think something else was going on there. So after, after I'm I have just died in that little ER room, and he saw me open my eyes at the last minute and then plop down on the gurney. And the medical staff come in and they shoo him out into the hallway, backing up a little bit here. So he's out in that hallway waiting, waiting. And he said, in that moment, he was thinking, what do I do now? For 29 months, I've taken care of this woman. I've made sure she stayed alive. I've helped her through these suicidal temptations inch by inch. I've done everything I can do to keep her alive, and now she's dead. What do I do? Do I quit my job? Do I move somewhere? Where do I go from here? And he said he was really trying to think, what just happened and what do I do? And he said an angel came to him in that hallway and said, we just need her for a few minutes. She'll be back. It's okay. And actually, he said, because I asked him a lot about this, he volunteered this information. He said it was like somebody came up and draped a blanket of comfort and peace and reassurance around his shoulders. And this was not a being that appeared, but a very clearly spoken message that just said, it's okay. She's coming back. We just need her for a few minutes. Don't be afraid. And he said it was not, sometimes you hear the angels and you think, well, I'm pretty sure I got that right. But he said in his case, he thought, oh, okay, she's coming back. You just need her for a few minutes. And he went out to the lobby and got himself a soda. And later, when he told me this, I said, what? You got yourself a soda? I'm dead. You're buying a drink out there? And he said, well, the angels were pretty clear. There was no iffy about this. They were very definitive in their explanation. So, and after he got a soda, he went back to his position on the hall. And part of what's so cool about this, after I was in the hospital for 4 days, after this, I was admitted to a hospital and I remained there for 4.5 days. And it was actually after I was back home that he shared this story with me. And I was flopped out on my couch, and his sister Mabel, who ended up staying a lot more longer than she intended to, she was seated across from us. And so I was sitting laying on the couch, and Milton was seated in front of me, Mabel was seated in front of me, and Milton told this story about the angel. And I said, so Milton, what did this do to your belief system? And he said, a little bit deflated, he said, it has shattered every single thing I've ever believed. And he said, if there are angels, there must be a God. And for you to come back, there must be a heaven. So life goes on. He said, there must be a God and a savior. And it really changed him in so many ways. And his sister, very precious, dear woman, became emotional. And she said, brother, I have been praying for 40 years that you would find out about the love of Jesus and the power of God, and it's finally happened. And I thought to myself, I'm still a little miffed about being back on earth, still having some mixed feelings about all that. But I thought to myself at that moment, if this is the reason that I returned, then that's a good reason. That is a good reason. And excuse me, it's been 2.5 years since this happened, a little more than 2.5 years now. This happened September 2018. Since then, Milton texts me these beautiful Bible verses, these incredible insights. He has been a spiritual guiding light in my life. Sometimes I struggle with things, and he will tell me an interpretation he finds of a Bible verse that is a tremendous blessing to me. So, yes, this has changed him in the twinkling of an eye in ways that are beyond what I can describe. And I tell people he was in the blast radius. And he and I, people, a lot of people ask, are still in touch with Milton? I am. We are still living in the same, we both moved to the Midwest. So the rest of this is when I came back, I knew I had been healed. I was in the hospital for 4 days, and it was very, really very affirming. The next morning, when the real doctors came in, and they said, actually, a wonderful doctor said, you've had a heart attack. Rosemary, you've had a heart attack. I said, no, not me. I bike ride, I walk, and blah, blah, blah. He said, no, you've had a heart attack. He said, your enzymes are very elevated. And I said, I don't understand. I think you have the wrong folder. And he said, well, you lost so much blood, your heart stopped. So when that first message I heard was, my heart has stopped, I was right. And he said, he said, you lost so much blood. I said, well, how much blood did I lose? And he said, more than 40%. I said, well, like 52%, 61%, what exactly? And he said, well, once you go past 40%, doesn't matter, your heart stopped. So it was very affirming. And then they hauled me off for a bunch of tests. There's a pretty strong belief in the medical system that once you bleed to death and are gone for 10 minutes, there's going to be damage to your heart, your liver, your kidneys, multiple organs, et cetera. Plus, I actually learned from a medical professional, when you bleed out like that, your veins and arteries can get sticky, and it can be hard to kind of reinflate all those things. And I had more than one person ask me if I suffered any peripheral nerve damage, and nothing, absolutely nothing. So while they're hauling me off in the hospital, you know, this first day, so they haul me off for all these tests. And I remember one, they took me down the hall for an echocardiogram, and I on the gurney, they had me on complete bed rest for 4 days. I wasn't even supposed to lift my head except to sip on my apple juice. And I said, hey, you know what? We don't need to do these tests. The angels told me if I agreed to come back, I'd be healed. So, you know, I'm fine, 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 fine. We don't need to do any of this stuff. And they said, we're going to do the test anyway. And without exception, the doctor would come in and say, well, Rosemary, you're awfully lucky. Your heart's fine. There's absolutely no damage to your heart. Your kidneys are fine. Your liver's fine. Everything seems fine. And the big healing was the healing of my soul. Shortly after I was back home from the hospital, I plopped down on the floor with my Bible, and I read, my Bible opened up to the 23rd Psalm, and my eyes fell on the verse, he restoreth my soul. And I cried. I cried for some time because I realized that was the real healing. My soul had been restored, and that's a lot bigger than healing a body. And I felt restored, as Milton is in IT, and he says, you got rebooted by the creator. And that's right. And it took a lot of tests and a lot of time. I had to find another oncologist, because when you go to your oncologist and you say, by the way, the angel said I was healed in heaven, we don't need to do this chemo, this radiation business, I'm just fine. They don't take it well. So I had to find another oncologist. And that took some time, because while I'm busy saying I was healed in heaven, but, you know, let's be sure, they're saying, wait, you bled to death from a cervical biopsy. Let's go back to that story. And I said, no, that's old news. But yeah, it took some time, took some effort, took more procedures. But ultimately, actually, I took another surgery, which I was not too keen on. But that was another gynecological oncologist. But she, after that surgery, my buddy Milton, again, in the waiting room waiting for me, he said she came out of the surgical suite, came into the waiting room, literally threw her arms around his neck and said, she's right. Not only is there not one cell of cancer, but her flesh is so pink and perfect and pretty. I don't think she ever had cancer. So, you know, I'm unspeakably grateful that I did not have to deal with that. That is a heavy burden. I know a lot of people go through it, but the real healing was the restoration of my soul. That desire to die left me. There were so many et ceteras to this. I don't know where we are on time. Yep, we're close to time. But very briefly after this, I sold off everything I own. I was living in a home I owned at this point. I sold off all my personal possessions. I sold my brand new car. I took it back to the dealership and said, I don't need this anymore. Will you buy it back? I sold off my home. I listed it and it sold in 2 hours. Literally somebody knocked on the door and said, I'll take it. And then I moved 1,000 miles due west to live with my a family member who was living alone in a big house. And I just moved into his bedroom. And I realized that all these possessions I've been hauling around through my life meant nothing to me. The happiest I had ever known was my time out of the body when I had nothing, no possessions. So it changed me in every way a person can be changed. I had an interview with a neuroscientist who said, what's remarkable about your story? She said, you know, the story about the floating in the white room is great. She said, but the most remarkable part to me as a neuroscientist is that you changed every single facet of your life. Humans don't do that. We like our routines. We like things the way they always are. She said, but for this to change everything about who you are and how you see the world, she said, to me, as a neuroscientist, that's one of the most remarkable parts of your story. So there's a lot more to it, but that's about an hour. And I know we want to do some questions and answers. So I hope you enjoyed it. And I think we'll go to questions and answers now.
All right, everyone, if you have a question, please type it in the chat box and we'll read them as they come on in. So Rosemary, Is Milton got a religion now of some sort, or is he just a kind of an independent spiritual person? What's happened with Milton?
Well, I would categorize his belief system as the Christian belief system. As a boy, he was raised, I think it was the Methodist Church, and he was a very, very intelligent little kid. And at age 10, he asked a Sunday school teacher a question, and the teacher responded with something like, we don't ask those questions in Sunday school. You know, it was something like, how do we know God exists? And they didn't like that. So that kind of, and then there were some other things that happened. But so we did have a foundation in the church. But as to your question right now, he's very faithful about reading the Bible. I don't know about his church goings on, but he's truly one of the most spiritually minded men I'm aware of.
So not affiliated that you know of. You mentioned that you have relatives who have heard about this, and tell me a little bit about those reactions. How do they react to your story?
Oh, my relatives? Well, you know, it's interesting. I have three daughters, all in their 30s and 40s. I did not tell them anything about this cancer diagnosis or that I was going into the hospital. So I called them up after I was back home. And I said, hey, how's it going? And they said, hi, Mom, what's happening? I said, well, you know, I had this little thing. I went into the hospital. They made a boo-boo. I bled to death. I died. My heart stopped. I went to heaven, talked to God, saw the angels, and came back, and I'm just great now. How are you? And they said, what? So that was kind of a lot to take in.
Okay. We've got a question that said, what did you learn about God directly from your experience? We can tell you were a Christian before. What additional things did you learn about God from your experience that were new to you?
What a lovely question. You know, I got a question. I give these talks quite a bit. I got a question the other day. Somebody said, how do you know it wasn't a nurse that whispered to Milton that they only needed you for a few minutes and you'd be right back? And I said, well, I think nurse versus angel, I think that's going to be pretty clear. And I said, it was a feeling. And thirdly, what nurse would come out and say, we just need her for a few minutes? You know, we just want to poke her with a stick for a while. I don't know. But anyway, I digress. The question was, what new thing did I learn about God? The most remarkable thing I learned about God, when I came back from this, oh man, this did not go well for me. Initially, when I told people about, you know, you're the image and likeness, I'm the original, that was profound for me. And I went around telling people I met Big Rosemary, and that did not go well. And I did not mean it in a flippant way or an irreverent way, but it enabled me to see that I am just the image and likeness of God. So that was life-changing. The other thing I learned, I had a not very nice father. When I was a kid, my father didn't have any pictures of me on his desk. He had pictures of my brothers, but none of me. And he said, when you do something worthwhile, you'll earn a picture on my desk. Well, I never did get a picture on his desk. And when I was 14, he took off and never saw him again. So that's what I thought of as God, a pretty angry father that you really had to work hard to earn a place in his good stead, to earn a place to have your picture on his desk. And what I learned was that God, and again, this is not irreverent, but that God really, really, really likes us, that God just enjoys us, that God just thinks we're great right where we are, that God doesn't say, when you get your name in the paper, you know, we'll talk. That God just cherishes us and likes us. I mean, we all know that God loves us. So I guess that was a life-changing thing. And then the other thing I learned is those prayers of petition, heal me or let me die, I got both. And then no more hard decisions. That was very specifically answered. And then the third one, no life review, no hard decisions. So my point is prayers of petition are powerful. That was a new insight for me.
Okay, another question from Valerie. Do you have to actively work to stay out of despair, or do you feel healed emotionally through each day in a long-term way?
Yes, I do have to work, and sometimes I don't do very well. In fact, I had a crying jag today. It's just life got to me. The COVID isolation has been tough. I'm not married. I'm not connected to anybody. I'm, you know, Milton's a very dear friend, but it's very hard in this time of COVID to be alone in the world. And I do have to work. And sometimes I don't work very well. And sometimes I feel sad. I'm not some enlightened one. I'm just a human being that glimpsed heaven and came back. Gosh, just the other day, I took a bad stumble. I was out speed walking in the dark on a country road, not my best move, but I took a bad fall and injured myself pretty thoroughly. And I thought, boy, you know, for somebody who's been to heaven and back, you know, that was a pretty dumb thing to do. And where are my angels, man? Where are my angels? Why did I bust myself up like that? So yes, I still have many, many typically human struggles.
Another question. Apparently you have an interesting sense of humor, a good sense of humor, excuse me. I should never say interesting, but did you learn anything about God having a sense of humor?
Did I learn anything about God having a sense of humor? What a wonderful question. I guess I did, because that whole thing, you're the image and likeness, I'm the original. And I said, I'm not actually, you know, I'm talking to myself. I said, I'm not dying, I'm dead. I mean, what's the source? I'm not the source of that. And, you know, one of the fascinating things, we tend to think memory is stored in the brain, 7 pounds of hamburger meat. No, all my memories went with me. Memory is not about the brain. Memory is, you know, our essence, our soul. So, yeah, when I said God really, really, really likes us, I think, I guess my impression was that God delights in us. God likes laughter. God, you know, I do have an answer for that. When I came back from this experience, I was tossed in onto another gurney, and they had an ambulance waiting. I mean, the ambulance was there before I lost consciousness, but I don't know, but I suspect I wasn't on that ER gurney for more than 2 or 3 minutes before they slung me like a slab of pork onto a gurney and whisked me out of there. I mean, I think they were very frightened that I would die again and they couldn't get me back. I think that's why I got transported so quickly. So I'm loaded in the back of an ambulance. I'm transported to the hospital that did the original surgery, and boy, did we fly. We went very, very fast. But in the ambulance, now they've got an oxygen mask over my nose and mouth. And my friend Milton said I was white as a sheet with blue lips and blue under my eyes, did not look good. And while I'm in that ambulance, the angels were right there with me. And I mean, lots of them. And it's like the walls of the ambulance weren't even there. It's just, I was surrounded by too many angels to count. And they were telling me so many funny stories. And I was laughing and laughing. And I know to the attendants, I must have looked like I'd gone around the bend. But I remember more than once I took the oxygen mask off my face just so I could laugh better. And, you know, the attendant would reach over and snap it back on. So I thought that was so interesting that here I have just come back from the dead, and the angels aren't reciting Bible verses. They're not singing beautiful songs. They're telling me these funny, funny stories. And it was great. So yes, I do think God delights in our sense of humor.
Okay. What would you say to people who are contemplating suicide?
NBC series called The Blacklist with Red Reddington. And the best explanation I've ever heard of suicide is where he talks about killing yourself is like a suicide bomber that straps all the explosives onto a vest and then detonates himself. Those closest to the suicide bomber are destroyed. They may be alive, but they no longer have any reason to keep going. To somebody contemplating suicide, I will tell you, it destroys those who love you. It literally destroyed me. Absent this, had this not happened to me, I have no doubt I would have ended my life by now. I came perilously close to ending my life repeatedly. So I can speak more from the perspective of somebody who's survived it. My husband's last words on this earth were a text message he sent me blaming me for this horrible act. I am in a group on Facebook, a wonderful group of women who have lost their husband to suicide. And I can tell you that 5, 7, 10 years out, we still cry. We still hurt. To somebody contemplating it, I would say it is the fastest way to destroy anybody that loves you. And I mean destroy And the odds are, gosh, in this in this group I'm in Facebook, we've had three women end their own lives. So, yeah, and that's what I was saying at the beginning of this. Statistics, again, depending on whose numbers you read, suicide survivors are 12 to 48 times more likely than the general population to take their life. So if we want to talk about suicide prevention, stop talking about the person who already killed themselves and talk about the women or the men who are surviving this. I used to go to some suicide support groups, you know, before COVID, and we all kind of agree that you'll never have a happy day again, but you'll learn how to have happy moments within the days. And while this has been a remarkable restoration of my life and my soul, the fact is I still struggle. This has not been just a happy, complete reset of everything. I was married to a man that I loved, prayed for, and adored, and his end was very grisly. And that's, I the other day, in fact, just the other day, I was going through unpacking some things. I moved into a home of my own finally. And I was unpacking some things, and I came across a CD, and I had dated it, I think it was dated April 2015. And without thinking, I said out loud to myself, oh, that's when I was happy. That was before. And that is just going to be with me. My life is divided into before he killed himself and after he killed himself. I'm sorry I don't have a better answer. I would say get help. I would say think about what it's going to do to others. I would say realize that sometimes chemicals do help, but it destroys people. And a PS to this, and this is something I wish I could share with the world. When your husband or your spouse or somebody you love does this, you become the prime suspect. This is a death like no other. I was questioned. I was interrogated by the cops as to the nature of my final argument with my husband. And that is very common, that those involved get questioned. The person who found my husband got sat in a chair and questioned for 5 hours. He just had the misfortune to find my husband's body, to be the first one on the scene. So it's a homicide by a person's own hand.
Next question. You were created in the image of God. Did you have a sense about any femininity about the spirit?
A sense about what?
Well, did you have a sense that it was a female spirit, is what I guess they ask.
I think that's a great question. And my answer is, I've thought about this a lot. My answer is, no. I had a father that was not kind. I had a mother that was wonderful. So when I think about God, I always thought about God as mother love, because I could understand a mother loving me. I couldn't understand a dad. And so this new God that I met was a God that was, to answer the question, I say male and female, but neither. You know, I know that sounds kind of nebulous, but that's the best I got. I didn't interpret a sexual identity.
Okay. Do you believe you came back for a specific purpose?
I wonder about that every stinking day. After I took my speed walk on the rural country road in the dark and busted up everything from the crown of my head to my toes, lying in bed for 3 days waiting to be able to walk again and move again, I asked, okay, what's the plan? What are we doing? Why did we bring Rosemary back? I don't know. I don't know. I have not discerned a specific purpose. I give quite a few of these talks. My story's been heard by lots of folks. I hope it provides them inspiration and encouragement. I hope it does what it did for Milton 10 million times over. We seem to become an increasingly secular society that disparages anybody who believes in something beyond this biological life. So yeah, I don't feel that I have a specific purpose, but I feel like I would love people to know. There is so much more going on than we can see with our eyeballs.
Okay. They enjoyed your sense of humor. One person says, has questions about being created in God's image. Does that mean that there's more than one image of God? I don't know. That's an unusual question. I don't know if there's any answer.
Yeah, but, well, I just saw that comment. Your sense from Jill Young, your sense of humor is not just interesting, it's fantastic. Thank you. I love that. What a lovely thing to say. I love, as Mark Twain said, I can go for 30 days on one good compliment. About the image and likeness of God, I have thought about that quite a bit. And the best way I can come up with it is it's like the light pouring into a prism. And the prism reflects and deflects the light in infinite ways. And so I think that we are the prismatic reflection of the divine. That's what I how I see it.
And now another very common question. Did you come back with any additional gifts?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think it was kind of a supercharge of the event in 1959 when I was born. I can't say that I came back with any additional gifts. The biggest thing that I came back with, one of the big things, I had been ruminating about my husband's death. I felt very guilty about what he had done. I felt like I had been given my husband to be his spiritual guardian and to help. He was an agnostic. I felt like it was my duty to teach him about the things of God, and I had failed, and I had immeasurable guilt about that. So one of the things I asked, after I came back from this, you know, people say, I feel like I was, after the experience, I was 50% in this world and 50% in that one. I did not feel that. I felt like I was 95% in that world and maybe 5% in this one. So I had the audience of the angels, and I asked them a gajillion questions. And one of my questions was, did I fail? I had self-appointed myself as his spiritual guardian. Did I fail? And they said, no, we enter the kingdom of heaven single file. You know, we are to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. It was not your job to work out his salvation. And I cried. I wept. I thought, wow, I have self-imposed this guilt about being responsible for his spiritual reality, and it's not mine. And I said, where is he now? And they said, he's with us. And I said, so what's happening to him right now? And they said, and this is great. People don't like this, but they said, none of your business. And I said, wait, what? It seems a little brusque for the angels to keep company with Most High God. None of my business. And yet it was exactly what I needed to hear. It was kind of an admonishing, but it also helped get me out of those endless ruminations. Why did he do this? I thought he loved me. I don't understand. Why did he do this? I thought he loved me. I don't understand. And it was actually very liberating that I was not responsible for this man anymore. I took a vow that said, till death do us part. And I realized I could let him go. I could stop ruminating over it. Every minute of every day of my life, I could stop obsessing over it. And it was really like I had been in these horrible shackles in misery over what he had done. And these answers from the angels literally set me free. They literally took the shackles off. So as far as coming back with any special gifts, I really feel like it was just more of the same. You know, I felt like I was more in tune with the divine. And yet, boy, does that take work. I really thought I would stay on this pinnacle, the spiritual pinnacle, for the rest of my days. Nope, it is a challenge. So I haven't had any psychic gifts. I don't do tarot cards. I don't hear the guides talking to me. I do try very hard to commune with the angels and ask daily, minute by minute sometimes, to always be divinely led and to do the right thing at the right time.
Well, that's great. One other question dealing with that is, what are some other questions and answers you've received from interaction with the angels?
There were a lot. My goodness, I don't know. That's kind of another hour lecture. One of the things that happened, Mabel or Milton stayed with me in the hospital room. Because, well, you know, I came back from the dead and all that. I was still a little confused at times, you know, bleeding to death and all that left me in kind of a compromised state. But there were times that Milton or Mabel or one of the other dear friends that came to the hospital had to leave. And at those times that I was alone in the hospital, the angels would come to my bedside and sing me songs. And they sang me the most beautiful songs you can imagine. And I would just sob. I'd be lying because I was on, like I said, total bed rest. Lying on my back in the bed, I could see them, I could feel them, I could hear them. And the songs were so beautiful. And as they sang, and they were in a humanesque form, but they were sparkly and bright. And as they sang, the sparkles got brighter and brighter and brighter, and their songs glorified God. And I told the angels, I said, I am really good with architecture. I am really good with memorizing houses. I got a great visual memory, but I'm not so good with melody and lyrics. I'm not going to be able to remember this most beautiful music anyone could ever imagine. And the angels said, this is not for you to remember. This is for your healing. This is for your joy. This is for your peace. This is our thank you to you for coming back. And that was a pretty intense memory.
All right. People are thanking you for in helping them understand God's plan. You ask questions of the angels, are you willing to write a book to tell us about your answers?
Yes. Well, I do have a book. It's going to be out one day soon, I hope.
All right. That's the end of the questions and answers. So, Rosemary, thank you so much for addressing our group. And when you come to it, we feel like Rosemary is going to come to our group in person. And when she's here, we can all applaud. But right now, everybody's muted, so you can't hear.
Well, and if anyone wants to contact me, my website, probably the easiest way to contact me is through my website, which is searshomes.org. And there's contact information there. Again, it's a remnant from my architecture, so it's searshomes.org.
And Martin just showed up again. Martin, do you have any last words? Or he's muted, so I guess not.
works better with the microphone on. I wanted to thank everyone for participating and listening, and Rosemary for such an amazing presentation. You shared great words of wisdom from your amazing experience. No other word for it. Thank you so very much.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, everyone, and good night.